2. In my childhood, I never heard the word Australia without calling to mind the fumes of the eucalyptus inhaler and an incessant red country populated by sheep. My father loved to tell, and we to hear, the story of the Australian sheep millionaire who strolled into a Rolls-Royce showroom in London, scorned all the smaller models, chose an enormous limousine with a plate glass panel between the chauffeur and passengers, and added, cockily, as he counted out the cash, "That'll stop the sheep from breathing down my neck." I also knew from my great-aunt Ruth that Australia was the country of the upside-downers. A hole bored straight through the earth from England would burst out under their feet. "Why don't they fall off?" I asked. "Gravity," she whispered. She had in her library a book about the continent, and I would gaze in wonder at pictures of the koala and kookaburra, the platypus and Tasmanian bush devil, old man kangaroo and yellow dog dingo, and Sydney Harbour Bridge. But the picture I liked best showed an Aboriginal family on the move. They were lean, angular people, and they went about naked. Their skin was very black, not the glitter black of Negroes, but matte black, as if the sun had sucked away all possibility of reflection. The man had a long forked beard and carried a spear or two, and a spear thrower. The woman carried a dilly bag and a baby at her breast. A small boy strolled beside her. I identified myself with him. I remember the fantastic homelessness of my first 5 years. My father was in the Navy, at sea. My mother and I would shuttle back and forth on the railways of wartime England, on visits to family and friends. All the frenzied agitation of the times communicated itself to me. The hiss of steam on a fog-bound station, the double clunk of carriage doors closing, the drone of aircraft, the searchlights, the sirens, the sound of a mouth organ along a platform of sleeping soldiers. Home, if we had one, was a solid black suitcase, called the Rev Robe, in which was a corner for my clothes and my Mickey Mouse gas mask. I knew that once the bombs began to fall, I could curl up inside the Rev Robe and be safe. Sometimes I would stay for months with my two great aunts in their terrace house behind the church in Stratford-on-Avon. They were old maids. Auntie Katie was a painter and had travelled. In Paris, she had been to a very louche party at the studio of Mr. Kees van Dongen. On Capri, she had seen the bowler hat of a Mr. Ulyanov that used to bob along the Piccolo Marina. Aunt Ruth had travelled only once in her life, to Flanders, to lay a wreath on a loved one's grave. She had a simple, trusting nature. Her cheeks were pale rose pink, and she could blush as sweetly and innocently as a young girl. She was very deaf, and I would have to yell into her deaf aid, which looked like a portable radio. At her bedside, she kept a photograph of her favourite nephew, my father, gazing calmly from under the patent peak of his naval officer's cap. The men on my father's side of the family were either solid or sedentary citizens, lawyers, architects, antiquaries, or horizon-struck wanderers who had scattered their bones in every corner of the earth. Cousin Charlie in Patagonia, Uncle Victor in a Yukon gold camp, Uncle Robert in an Oriental port, Uncle Desmond of the long fair hair, who vanished without trace in Paris, Uncle Walter, who died chanting the surahs of the glorious Quran in a hospital for holy men in Cairo. Sometimes I overheard my aunts discussing these blighted destinies, and Aunt Ruth would hug me as if to forestall my following in their footsteps. Yet from the way she lingered over such words as Xanadu or Samarkand or the wine dark sea, I think she also felt the trouble of the wanderer in her soul. The house was full of cumbersome furniture, inherited from the days of lofty ceilings and servants. In the drawing room, there were William Morris curtains, a piano, a cabinet of porcelain, and a canvas of cockle pickers by Aunt Katie's friend A. E. Russell. My own most treasured possession at the time was the conch shell, called Mona, which my father had brought from the West Indies. I would ram my face against her sheeny pink vulva and listen to the sound of the surf. One day, after Aunt Katie had shown me a print of Botticelli's Birth of Venus, I prayed and prayed that a beautiful blonde young lady would suddenly spew forth from Mona. Aunt Ruth never scolded me, except once, one evening in May 1944, when I pissed in the bathwater. I must be one of the last children anywhere to be menaced by the spectre of Bonaparte. "If you ever do that again," she cried, "Boney will get you." I knew what Boney looked like from his porcelain statuette in the cabinet, black boots, white breeches, gilded buttons, and a black bicorn hat. But the drawing Aunt Ruth drew for me, a version of one drawn for her as a child by her father's friend Lawrence Alma Tadema, showed the furry bicorn only on a pair of spindly legs. That night, and for weeks to come, I dreamed of meeting Boney on the pavement outside the vicarage. His two halves would open like a bivalve. Inside there were rows of black fangs and a mass of wiry blue-black hair, into which I fell and woke up screaming. On Fridays, Aunt Ruth and I would walk to the parish church to make it ready for Sunday service. She would polish the brasses, sweep the choir stalls, replace the frontal and arrange fresh flowers on the altar, while I clambered into the pulpit or held imaginary conversations with Mr. Shakespeare. Mr. Shakespeare would peer from his funerary monument on the north side of the chancel. He was a bald man with upturned moustaches. His left hand rested on a scroll of paper, and his right hand held a quill. I appointed myself the guardian and guide of his tomb, and charged G.I.'s 3 pence a tour. The first lines of verse I learned by heart were the 4 lines engraved on his slab. "Good friend, for Jesus' sake forbear, to digger the dust enclosed here. Blessed be ye man, yet spares these stones, and cursed be he, yet moves my bones." Long afterwards in Hungary, where I had gone to study the archaeology of nomads, I had the luck to witness the opening of a Hunnish princess's grave. The girl lay on her back, on a bed of black soil, her brittle bones covered with a shower of gold plaques, while across her breast, with wings outspread, lay the skeleton of a golden eagle. One of the excavators called to some peasant women, who were haymaking in the field nearby. They dropped their rakes and clustered round the grave mouth, crossing themselves fumble-handedly, as if to say, leave her with her lover, leave her alone with Zeus. "Cursed be he," I seemed to hear Mr. Shakespeare calling, and for the first time began to wonder if archaeology itself were not cursed. Whenever the afternoon was fine in Stratford, Aunt Ruth and I, with her cocker spaniel Amber straining at his leash, would go on what she said was Mr. Shakespeare's favourite walk. We would set off from College Street, past the grain silo, past the foaming mill race, across the Avon by footbridge, and follow the path to Weir Break. This was a hazel wood on a slope that tumbled into the river. In springtime, primroses and bluebells flowered there. In summer, it was a tangle of nettles, brambles, and purple loosestrife, with the muddy water eddying below. My aunt assured me this was the spot where Mr. Shakespeare came to tryst with a young lady. It was the very bank whereon the wild thyme blew. But she never explained what a tryst was, and no matter how hard I searched, there were neither thyme nor oxlips, although I did find a few nodding violets. Much later, when I had read Mr. Shakespeare's plays and did know what a tryst was, it struck me that Weir Break was far too muddy and prickly for Titania and Bottom to settle on, but an excellent spot for Ophelia to take the plunge. Aunt Ruth loved reading Shakespeare aloud, and on days when the grass was dry, I would dangle my legs over the riverbank and listen to her reciting, "If music be the food of love, the quality of mercy is not strained," or "Full fathom five, thy father lies." "Full fathom five" upset me terribly, because my father was still at sea. I had another recurring dream that his ship had sunk, that I grew gills and a fishy tail, swam down to join him on the ocean floor, and saw the pearls that had been his bright blue eyes. A year or two later, as a change from Mr. Shakespeare, my aunt would bring an anthology of verse especially chosen for travellers, called The Open Road. It had a green buckram binding and a flight of gilded swallows on the cover. I loved watching swallows. When they arrived in spring, I knew my lungs would soon be free of green phlegm. In autumn, when they sat chattering on the telegraph wires, I could almost count the days until the eucalyptus inhaler. Inside the open road, there were black and white end papers in the style of Aubrey Beardsley, which showed a bright path twisting through pine woods. One by one, we went through every poem in the book. We arose and went to Innisfree. We saw the caverns measureless to man. We wandered lonely as a cloud. We tasted all the summer's pride, wept for Lycidas, stood in tears among the alien corn, and listened to the strident, beckoning music of Walt Whitman. O public road, you express me better than I can express myself. You shall be more to me than my poem. One day, Aunt Ruth told me our surname had once been Chetwynd, which meant the winding path in Anglo-Saxon, and the suggestion took root in my head that poetry, my own name, and the road were all three mysteriously connected. As for bedtime stories, my favourite was the tale of the coyote pup in Ernest Thompson Seton's Lives of the Hunted. Coyotito was the runt of a litter whose mother had been shot by the cowboy, Wolver Jake. Her brothers and sisters had been knocked on the head, and her own life spared to give sport to Jake's bull terrier and greyhounds. Her picture, in chains, showed the saddest little dog person I ever saw. Yet Coyotito grew up smart, and one morning, after shamming dead, she bolted for the wild, there to teach a new generation of coyotes the art of avoiding men. I cannot now piece together the train of associations that led me to connect Coyotito's bid for freedom with the Australian Aboriginals' walkabout, nor, for that matter, where I first heard the expression walkabout, yet somehow I picked up an image of those tame black fellows who, one day, would be working happily on a cattle station, the next, without a word of warning and for no good reason, would up sticks and vanish into the blue. They would step from their work clothes and leave, for weeks and months and even years, trekking halfway across the continent, if only to meet a man, then trekking back as if nothing had happened. I tried to picture their employer's face the moment he found them gone. He would be a Scot, perhaps, a big man with blotchy skin and a mouthful of obscenities. I imagined him breakfasting on steak and eggs. In the days of food rationing, we knew that all Australians ate a pound of steak for breakfast. Then he would march into the blinding sunlight, all Australian sunlight was blinding, and shout for his boys. Nothing. He would shout again, not a sound but the mocking laugh of a kookaburra. He would scan the horizon, nothing but gum trees. He would stalk through the cattle yards, nothing there either. Then, outside their shacks, he'd find their shirts and hats and boots sticking up through their trousers.